40% off pads, tampons, condoms. Stay tuned because Lola is giving Sex Gets Real listeners 40% off. Details in the show notes and at sexgetsreal.com/EP248. You're listening to Sex Gets Real with Dawn Sarah. That's me. This is a place where we explore sex, bodies, and relationships from a place of curiosity and inclusion, tying the personal to the cultural, where you're just as likely to hear tender questions about shame and the complexities of love as you are to hear experts challenging the dominant stories around pleasure, body politics, and liberation. This is about the big and the small, about sex and everything surrounding it we don't usually name. The funny, the awkward, the imperfect happen here in service to joy, connection, healing, and creating healthier relationships with ourselves and each other. So welcome to Sex Gets Real. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Hey you, welcome to this week's episode of Sex Gets Real. Oh my God. This conversation with Leonor Chia is one I cannot wait to hear what you think. Leonor and I regularly have Skype dates where we talk about what's going on in each other's lives and practices and the big, huge thoughts that we're contemplating around the state of the world, the future of humanity, and how sexuality fits into all of it. And this week, Leonor is joining us here, and you get to basically be a fly on the wall for one of our geek-tastic conversations. We talk all about wildness and domestication around our sexuality, the erotic as this vast, unownable resource that we get to be in relationship with, and how so often our entry point into learning about sex is about individualism and finding our own version of that, and how what's beyond that is so much more vast. We talk about internal family systems and inner critics, and some of the ways that our inner critic is actually trying so hard to protect us. We talk about mystery and why, how so often when we think we're hungry for new people in relationship, we're actually hungry for new versions of ourself, and how we can move through the feast and the famine of the erotic and our sexuality in a way that fosters more mystery in our lives. It's such a rich discussion. I can't wait for you to hear it. But before we get to that, a couple of things. So first off, in this episode, you're going to hear an ad for Lola because they are giving listeners 40% off their first order. It's all organic cotton pads and tampons, plus Sex by Lola includes their super thin condoms that are very high quality. You can get details about how to grab that discount code and cash it in at mylola.com by listening or by clicking through to the show notes or heading to sexgetsreal.com/EP248. All of the details are on the page for this episode. Also, if you didn't hear last week, we hit 5 million downloads a couple of weeks ago, and there is a massive giveaway that I'm doing. 3 lucky people will be randomly selected from the pool of those of you who want to participate and help me ring in the 5 million milestone. There's all kinds of yummy things that I'm giving away, from lube and books to discounts and a really fun consent board game. So if you want to put your name and your email in the hat to be considered for the random drawing helping me to celebrate this 5 million milestone, then you can go to sexgetsreal.com/5, F-I-V-E. And then, of course, Explore More Summit 2019 is happening and registration is now open. You can grab your free ticket to this entirely online conference that I put on every single year at exploremoresummit.com. Leonor is one of the speakers, and there are incredible conversations happening this year. The kind of stuff that is like shifting me in really important ways, and I think you're going to love it. The theme this year is all around pleasure. So we're talking about all of the things that we can do that expand our access to pleasure, that expand our understanding of pleasure, that get in the way of our pleasure, and really finding new stories and new access points so that we can have more pleasure in our lives without guilt or shame or fear. So again, exploremoresummit.com to grab your free ticket to the conference. It starts February 25th and goes for 10 days. You do not want to miss it. So let me tell you a little bit about Leonore and Patreon supporters. Also, if you go to patreon.com/sgrpodcast and support the show at $3 a month and above, you get exclusive weekly content that you can't find anywhere else. Leonore and I this week for our bonus chat talk all about how BDSM can be this really beautiful way of actually working through and healing trauma and stuck stories. So we're going to talk all things kink and BDSM over on that Patreon bonus. Check it out. Plus an exclusive discount just for Patreon supporters on Explore More Summit bonuses. So again, patreon.com/sgrpodcast for Sex Gets Real. So Leonore Chia is a feminist sexuality educator who helps people create more presence, play, pleasure, and power in the bedroom and beyond. As a trained practitioner of internal family systems therapy, she assists people in recovering the parts of their sexual selves that have been exiled and repressed. Her workshops and teaching bring an ecological focus to sexual empowerment, helping people to reconnect with erotic vitality and step into sexual wildness. Strap in, hold on. We are going big places in this conversation between me and Leonore. Hey everyone, welcome to Sex Gets Real and my chat with one of my favorite humans on the face of this planet, Leonore Chia. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Leonore.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Yeah. So as will become evident over the course of this conversation, you and I love having some like really challenging, heady, awesome conversations. And I'm hoping that unfolds for listeners to join us for today.
We're really into having brain sex together, Dawn.
Oh my God. We love having the brain sex. Seriously. So there's so much that I want to talk to you about. But for people who aren't familiar with you, would you mind just sharing a little bit about kind of who you are and the space that you take up in the world, especially around sexuality?
Yeah, totally. So I like to tell people that I'm a field guide to the inner world. I've worked in the field of adult sexuality education since about 2011, from a perspective of feminist sexual empowerment, working mostly with women around a wide variety of subjects around the body and communication and boundaries and kind of really offering like a holistic entryway into what does it mean to hold sexual empowerment in a female body in the 21st century. And I worked with a mentor named Amy Jo Goddard for about 6 years. I now have a private counseling practice that's based in internal family systems therapy. And I'm actually a co-leader for the American Psychological Association's Task Force on Consensual Non-Monogamy. So I advocate for therapist literacy around non-monogamy and polyamory, and run a variety of different programs and workshops that draw on things like embodiment, our personal sexual stories, mythology as a source of inspiration for our erotic journeys, and really looking at the erotic and our sexuality from a soul-centric perspective. Mm.
So lots of yumminess and lots of like really big, deep questions.
Yeah, we have lots of questions.
Yes. So you're also speaking at the Explore More Summit this year.
Yes.
And yes. So last year you did the closing ritual, which was fucking amazing. And we talked all about like inner critic work, which I'm sure we'll get to today. And then this year We spend a lot of time in our talk talking about wildness and domestication. And while I don't want to spoil the talk for anyone, I'd love for us to just kind of start there, because so much of who you are and the work that you do is about investigating this wilderness, this wildness that we carry that for many of us feels really foreign.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell me a little bit about like why wildness?
Yeah. Well, it's a personal, personally, it's a metaphor I've been hugely drawn to. I grew up in the city and really followed my heart to go live in the mountains in Vermont and became someone who hunted deer from a eco-feminist spiritual perspective. And there's been, in my whole life, a search for external and internal wildness, just as I, in my sexual journey, had to work through my own trauma and my internalized homophobia and the unconscious ways that I had kind of subjugated my own erotic life force. So I tell people that in the journey of sexual empowerment, I really know what it feels like to walk through the fire and have witnessed and assisted many people in their own journeys. But in around wilderness, I've really come to see that we in our hunger to express our sexual wildness, we are hungry to reconnect with that part of us that can never be tamed, can never be subjugated. And I believe that that really comes from the soul, you know, that comes from a place deep inside us, really from the essence of who we are. And it's very individual and personal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in the work of sexual empowerment, we're naturally encountering and working through the cultural stories about who we're supposed to be, the difficult personal experiences and traumas that have created these narratives about who we need to be in order to belong and to be safe and to be loved and so on and so forth. And to go deeper into finding our wildness, you know, what is that place in us that lies beyond domestication? Mm-hmm. And how do we really express that and create a life that honors that essence, even in such a imperfect world? That's the space that I'm holding in my perspectives and in my work with people.
What does it look like for us to really tap into that soul level expression of wildness and the erotic without it becoming another vehicle for like harm and abuse? Like, I could see so easily so many, just to speak kind of in broad brushstrokes, mm-hmm. like cis men saying like, oh, well, I was just expressing my inherent sexual needs when I, you know, grabbed this human being and mm-hmm. made them do the thing. So how do we hold the expansiveness of true wildness without it becoming a tool of violence or oppression?
Yeah, it's such a good question. The way that I've come to understand this is that, because I've been involved in so many different communities in which prominent teachers and leaders have exploited their students,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been involved, I've observed, I've seen it's, you know, it's absolutely, you know, our world is rife with it. The understanding that I've come to develop is that there's two different tracks involved. There's the track at which how skilled am I at accessing my internal wildness, you know, and holding that perspective. And then there's the completely different track, which is how much have I investigated my own relationship to power,
mm-hmm.
or looked at my privilege and worked to understand my blind spots. Mm-hmm. So they're actually two different things.
Yeah.
And it's really problematic when we have people who are represent themselves as teachers and healers, I mean, in sexuality and also in spirituality, because it's such a spiritual abuse is so rife mm-hmm. in our world. When you can have people who are very technically skilled and have developed their capacity as healers or teachers, but they have not worked at the psychological development or at creating the external practical structures that are necessary to wield power ethically.
Yes.
Yeah,
you had this beautiful line in a recent blog post on sexual healing and the uses of power that I love so much. And it says, our enthusiasm for sexual freedom and liberation needs to exist alongside a piercing inquiry into how we have internalized patriarchy, misogyny, homophobia, and transphobia, how we've internalized abusive messages around all kinds of power, and how we enact them unknowingly. And then, of course, that ties to like capitalism and charging money for these things and building livings off of these things. And I think that's something that a lot of people are really hesitant to do, because it's so hard for so many of us to even get to a place where we can talk about sex, kind of start confronting some of our shame, even allowing ourselves to fantasize and maybe even enact some of those fantasies, to then have this like responsibility. It really is a responsibility to also think like, are these fantasies informed by these really abusive systems that I exist in? And then how do we hold that like, yes, and I don't have to shame myself for it. Yes, it's natural that that happened. And what's some work that I need to do around really addressing and unpacking that?
Yeah. And I mean, that's another thing, right? It's so common to eroticize our own coping mechanisms for living inside of oppression. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think you articulate it really well. It's, you know, it's an amazing thing to be living at, we're in time where we are now, where there's so many different teachers and schools of thought and opportunities for sexual healing and empowerment that are coming to the forefront after like millennia of repression. But in our current marketplace of ideas and literal marketplace of products and services, I think it is really important that we continually come back to these questions of power and ethics, especially for those of us who are holding leadership positions, or at least presenting ourselves to be in leadership.
Yeah. So that's something you and I have personally talked about so much, especially in the past like 6 months, is just there's this tendency both culturally, I mean, we look at celebrity culture and see this enacted in so many ways, but specifically even within like sex positive community and within like spiritual community, there's this tendency to like position people as having the answers, and we need to go to them for those answers, or positioning them as being the experts in a thing. And how you and I are trying to really kind of move away from that, of like maybe instead being stewards or, you know, people who walk along beside and offer some questions so that people can find their own answers. Because it's such a mind fuck to say, I have answers. This technique is great. I'm going to charge money for it. And then let's try and cookie cutter this into your life.
Yeah, it's a difficult question when the bar is so incredibly low. The amount of sexual suffering in our world is so oceanic and vast. There really is a need for just a higher baseline of education from the beginning. I think what you're pointing out is just how desperately we often want to fix ourselves when we feel something is wrong. And we're very susceptible to giving away our own power to people in positions of authority. That's something I think we really need to inquire into in our approaches to sexual healing and transformation on a cultural level, I think that ultimately, at least in the space that I'm holding for people, I don't even really see myself as a teacher, but more as a guide in some ways, like a guide to unknown terrain and a space holder who's about creating spaces where people can really, really be witnessed in who they are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so much of so everything that we do for the most part is informed by the culture, the family, the communities that we're a part of. And most of us have been raised inside of a system that's taught us we are bad and broken if we aren't kind of performing at this peak level of success and productivity, and that we can buy things that fix us or at least band-aid problems temporarily to kind of let the pain off. What I find creates so much churn for people is they want to know there's an easy fix or an easy solution to the thing, because if there's not, then the level of grief and rage that comes up can feel really scary.
Totally. And from my perspective, I'm like, yeah, let's go to the grief and rage. Yeah. That's where the magic starts.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that you're bringing this up because, I mean, I certainly dwelled for many years in more of the, I think we're talking about an approach to our sexuality that's sort of about like finding solutions to things that aren't working, which yeah. absolutely has its place. I mean, there's so much that isn't working. And I know that the years that I spent in sort of that area of things where it was about like learning how to communicate better and learning different techniques to feel more pleasure and so on, like very useful, absolutely changed things. But there's more recently in my life, just speaking from my own personal journey, there's been a profound inner shift that's happened as I've really changed my orientation from it's not what we're doing, it's how we're being. Mm-hmm. It's not what we're creating, it's how we're relating internally, externally. And this has represented like a coming into the depths of life in a way that I didn't know was possible.
Mm.
I bring that perspective to the way I'm running my business and really seek to bring that to everything in my life, because I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be someone who presents the veneer of a perfect life, like a perfect sexual life or mm-hmm. whatever. And then I did this so I can help you have that too. That's really counter to my philosophy.
Yeah.
There's absolutely a level of dysfunction and pain where really concrete solutions are necessary,
yes.
you know, and like helping people to leave abusive relationships, helping people to just detoxify themselves of their internalized homophobia and so yeah. on. Like there really are things that require that kind of solution that's necessary for the empowerment. But more and more I find that the kinds of work I'm doing with people are, you know, some things like living a human life that's necessarily impermanent, like in a body that's going to continue to change.
Yeah.
And that's very impermanent and frail and vulnerable, and the ongoing vulnerability of being human and our emotions and what it means to be in relationship and sometimes really touch deep human pain that doesn't get fixed. It just gets related to differently. I mean, this is the realm in which we're, you know, it's not about what we're doing, it's how we're being with these things. And this is actually where I find so much of the erotic reveals itself, not as something that we own, but as a mystery that we get to be part of.
Oh, God, that's such an incredible thing to think about. And it's so utterly foreign in our neoliberal hyper-individual world that tells us everything is individual and everything is completely ours to own. And that kind of this larger collective experience is something we either don't know about or that we deride, because we
yeah.
have been taught that like being an individual human being is the peak
mm-hmm.
experience. Mm-hmm. And so I love this concept of like the erotic is this like greater mystery that we all have an opportunity to be in relationship with and move into different ways of being with, rather than I have to find my unique dawn way. And that's kind of like the end of the story.
The funny thing is that it's not either or.
Right.
But it's surrendering this notion that there's a right or a wrong way to be you is, I think, really the necessary mm-hmm. step into coming into this. And I'd love to read something that's been really inspiring me from this book, Advanced Spiritual Intimacy.
Yeah.
By Stuart Slovatsky. He writes, "We would like to own various powers, and popular psychology supports these aspirations with its encouragements to reclaim or own your sexuality. But the erotic powers of sexuality, love, attraction, arousal, fertility, families, and surrender are entrusted to us, or rather among us, and are not owned. Such slogans are merely transitional metaphors or therapeutic word tools to help us recover from domestic violence, depression, socio-political abuse, low self-esteem, or drug addiction. So I think that's pretty profound. He writes, often when people have suffered abuse, they need to learn how or when to say yes or no. And this quest for personal power or reclaiming sexuality is about respect. But ultimately, no one owns any part of nature, her spirit, nature's spirit, or its powers and beauties. And if we can discover the poetry of nature, if we can discover that the poetry of nature is what we seek through owning it or reclaiming it, we will find a kind of ecological balance that will always remain part of the mystery.
I had the opportunity to chat with Gloria Lucas from Nalgona Positivity Pride for the summit. And one of the things she shared in our talk was that for many Indigenous cultures, there is no language for my land.
Yep.
Or, you know, my home or my food, because there's this understanding that it's not about ownership, it's about being in relationship with.
Yes.
And I'm hearing so much of that in this very like decolonial approach of how can we possibly own fertility? How can we own birth? How can we own death? You know, those are things that like transcend the human experience. And so how, if we then can shift that relationship and that way of being, what becomes available to us when we realize it's so much bigger than ourselves?
Yes, exactly. And this is another layer of really understanding what wildness means in the context of the erotic is even as we, you know, here in our, in the West, we talk about water or land as a resource. And we talked about, talk about connecting with nature as something that helps us be more productive. What a sad understanding that is, you know, such a deep forgetting that water is not a resource. Water is the source of our life. And we don't connect with nature. We are nature.
Yeah.
We belong to nature.
Yeah.
And it's the same with sexuality at a certain level. I think it's very, it's useful to talk about owning and reclaiming our sexuality because, again, the bar is so low and we really need that support. But at a certain point, it is useful to actually surrender those I-centered approaches, you know?
Yeah.
And to see that these are bigger forces, that it's not something that we own and do and can do perfectly. They're bigger forces that we're blessed by and that we can choose how we relate to.
It makes me wonder if from the youngest of ages, we are invited into this dialogue with the erotic to see it as something that all of us were in relationship with in a variety of ways, and that we needed to be responsible about that relationship, both in how it expressed through ourselves and in how we expressed it with others. To me, it's almost like I'm having trouble finding the language or the words for what the potential for what that could do for then the ways we grew up and moved into our lives. I mean, it would shift so many of the dynamics that you're naming around, like, we have to have this piercing inquiry into patriarchy and power and misogyny and homophobia. It's like, could those things wouldn't be able to exist if more of us were in relationship with each other and the erotic in this kind of grander way that you're naming.
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately, Dawn, the work that we're doing is really about helping people to understand and shift their relationship to like this dominator culture that we've all been in, the water that we've been swimming in for thousands of years. And it doesn't just exist outside us. It exists inside us.
Yes.
In how we understand ourselves and how we relate to ourselves, including our sexuality. So, you know, what we're offering people is on the front end, it's about having better sex, having deeper intimacy, having more pleasure, and so on. We often do have to speak the language of increasing personal power because that's the only way people understand sexuality. But on the inside, it's an alchemical transformation into what it feels like to shift out of dominator culture and into a more partnership model or stewardship model, you know? But I almost fear we're getting too theoretical in this conversation.
Oh my God, I know. Yes. So listener, holding the gargantuan-ness of these ideas is something that we love doing, but not everybody necessarily wants to go so deep. So one of the things that we are kind of given being in the culture that we're in is this inner critic. And many of us have really dysfunctional relationships with our inner critic. We don't realize often the wisdom that it can offer and the reasons that it's speaking to this way. So many people come to me and where they're struggling, and I'm sure you as well and many other sex educators, is there is something wrong with me. I'm broken. I'm not doing XYZ right. Why won't my body do this thing? Why are these things so hard? And really feeling like there's something wrong or broken about the way that they're being and the way that they are in relationship to themselves and their loved ones and their sexuality. And you do internal family systems work, which is all about kind of investigating these inner voices that we all carry. So because a lot of people listening are probably in those places of feeling like, oh, my body isn't doing the things right, the way I show up in the world is wrong, how can we start investigating this inner critic landscape?
Yeah, totally. Oh my God, it's so real. I've so been there too, just years of being blended with that to the point I didn't even realize it was happening.
Yeah.
You know? So I think as with anything, it's beginning with bringing attention to it, of first understanding how does your inner critic show up. Oftentimes it's not only like a literal voice inside your head that yields the self-talk, but also like the kind of ongoing tension in our bodies, I think, is often really related to how much we carry around this.
Yeah.
Just feeling there's something wrong with us. Like, I know my inner critic is really up if I lose the ability to laugh at myself, for example. when my creativity is really blocked, you know, I think we have to start by just being attentive to, like, what does it feel like when it's there?
Yeah.
And yeah, from this perspective, from the internal family systems perspective, the inner critic is understood to be a protective part of us that's trying to whip us into shape, because it believes it's justified in being so hard on us, because it's trying to avoid the pain of, like, reactivating older embarrassments or humiliations or wounds. Like, my story is sort of like, if I work really hard to do things perfectly, then I won't feel the pain that I felt as a child when my hypercritical Chinese father always focused on the 1% of things that I did wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like the 99% that I did really well just doesn't matter. Just completely goes out the window, and I'm just hyper focused on that 1%, you know?
Yes.
So that inner critic part of me is like, okay, if I keep you really dialed into that 1%, then you won't feel the pain that you did before. But the attempt at protection becomes super dysfunctional and creates more problems, because then other parts of us hate the inner critic, want it to go away. You know, it devolves into this, like, shame about the shame. Like,
yes.
Oh, criticism of the criticism.
I'm and, so good at that.
Oh, it's so real. It's so real. And it just becomes like, we can just really live frozen there. You know, like, everything is wrong. Yeah. Everything we try to do is wrong. Oh, it's such a difficult place to be.
Yeah.
So the perspective that IFS offers is to notice that, yeah, when that inner critic is there, often we're like, hate it, we judge it, we want it to go away, we feel like it's ruining our lives. But the trick there is actually in slowing down with it enough to really check, like, how am I feeling towards this part? Like, how am I feeling towards my inner critic? And ironically, when we can actually bring some calm, some curiosity, and some compassion to it, it always relaxes.
Yeah.
Because the funny thing is that this part really does have good intentions, even when its behavior is super dysfunctional.
Uh-huh.
And so when we start to bring in questions of, like, hey, inner critic, what are you, like, why are you trying to do this for me? You know, what are you afraid would happen if you didn't work so hard?
Yeah.
Then we start to get a sense of why it is the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And getting that it actually does care for us because it's working so hard, even though other parts hate it and want it to go away. Yeah. And it is, instead of being a monster inside us, it often, you know, kind of changes shape into being like a protective sentinel part. It's just working extremely hard in a job that it's hated for, and trying to prevent the detonation of a deeper pain.
Mm.
And so when we shift to offering this part gratitude and compassion for what it does for us, it softens and relaxes.
Yeah.
And then this internal alchemy is taking place.
How would you like to get 40% off pads, tampons, condoms? Yes. Well, Sex Gets Real listeners can get just that, because Lola is sponsoring this week's episode. Lola is a female-founded company offering a line of organic cotton tampons, pads, and liners. They now offer sex products too. Lola makes your month a little bit easier. Their subscription is fully customizable. You can choose your mix of products, of absorbency, the number of boxes you get, and the frequency of delivery. Lola's subscription is super flexible. You can change, skip, or cancel at any time. You can choose from organic cotton tampons with either a BPA-free plastic applicator or no applicator at all, pads, liners, all natural cleansing wipes, or you can add a box of each. Plus, with Sex by Lola, you can also add things like condoms to your period subscription so that everything is packaged and delivered beautifully. Their packaging is beautiful. And discreetly right to your door. One of the reasons that Lola wanted to get into condoms is because until now, the only options have been products aggressively marketed towards men and their desires. But what about other needs? At Lola, women, and in parentheses, queer folks, come first. So you should be empowered to make decisions about your sex life. They have ultra-thin lubricated condoms made of natural rubber latex, and it comes with premium medical grade silicone. Plus, you do good with every purchase. Every purchase with Lola, they donate feminine care products to homeless shelters across the US. And if you know anything about homelessness, you know that getting period products is seriously expensive and really challenging. So this is an incredible thing that they're doing with every purchase. I love the convenience of not having to run out after my period has started. It just comes right to my door at a time frame that works for me. Plus, I love the ethics of this company, which is super important for me in deciding where I'm going to spend my money. So it's woman-owned, it comes to my door exactly when I need it to, and I can totally customize it based on my needs. Listeners, you can get 40% off your subscription at mylola.com, and you can enter SGR for Sex Gets Real at checkout when you subscribe in the discount code field. So 40% off with discount code SGR at mylola.com at checkout. So what are some of the things that you have witnessed around the ways inner critics show up specifically around like sexuality?
Here are some examples. Feeling like there's something wrong with our bodies. We don't want sex enough. We want sex too much. We're too slutty. We're not slutty enough. We don't orgasm. We orgasm too fast. There's something wrong with our sexual performance. We compare ourselves to other people. We're selfish if we ask for what we want. We're bad at asking for what we want. We're disappointing our partners. If we speak for what we need, then we're making them feel bad. You know,
mm-hmm.
If we have an STI, we're dirty. There's something wrong with our fantasies. We're not normal. You know, there's something wrong with us because our minds won't even shut up during sex. Mm-hmm. We're overanalyzing our partner. You know, we feel like there's something wrong with our attachment style. It's endless.
Yeah.
I have a list that on my, there's an email list. I have an email thing that goes out to people with this list, and people have written back to me and added more bullet points. So the list keeps it getting more longer and longer. I think it's an infinite list. Yeah.
And I think like the most important piece for me about that is How many of the things of the list that you just read have each of us thought some version of most of those things, or even some of those things? And if that's true, that most of us at some point have felt or thought one of the things on the list, then clearly the problem isn't us. Mm-hmm. Clearly the problem is the water we're swimming in, the way the world teaches us about our bodies, mm-hmm. all of, I mean, that's the thing that I just try to keep bringing people back to is like, yes, we say these things to ourselves. And so, yes, finding some support and new ways of relating to those things are important just for our own survival. But like beyond that, if so many people are worried about whether or not they're orgasming the right ways, or whether or not their genitals perform a certain way, or whether or not they speak up too much or not enough, it's not an individual problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Which is how it feels when we're in it. And that's super real. Like, I am fantastic at shaming myself about the things that I don't do well, because I know I should be doing better because of all whatever, you know, but mm-hmm. all, trying to remember in those moments, one, that it's going to pass. Two, there's a reason that I'm talking to myself this way. And three, like, someone else told me these things were bad. Someone mm-hmm. else told me I wasn't good enough if I did these things. Mm-hmm. And that for me has been really, really helpful in tapping into my anger. Mm-hmm. That like, I didn't come up with this shit on my own.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. It's so necessary to have spaces where we talk about these things, you know, whether that's in person or through listening to a podcast, the way you're helping people, Dawn. It's like, we just really, it's one thing to intellectually say to myself, I'm not the only person who feels this way, but it's another to like hear people's lived experiences and the pain that they've been through and be like, wow, this is really not our fault.
Yeah.
No, that's why the collective element is so important in the healing.
Yeah, it is. I'd love to talk about that a little bit more. You run some workshops both around like this wildness, but also mm-hmm. your mythology online calls and group work is something that I really want to amp up in 2019 and beyond, because I so want to combat this hyper individualism that has us all feeling so trapped. So in your experience, what are some of the things that happen when people get to explore their shame and their healing in groups?
It's vital that we do it together, because this is, as you've been saying, it's not an individual problem. It's a collective problem. And the issue with the shame is that we stay stuck in believing that we're the only one. So a huge part of the healing is just witnessing other people in their own struggles and realizing, wow, you know, as I said, like, this really isn't my fault, or this isn't our fault.
Yeah.
Oftentimes just seeing someone, you know, witnessing someone tell the story of their sexless marriage and how they felt so deficient, you know, and helpless inside it, and about their choice to leave that and choose something better for themselves. That is so healing for other people in the room who've had their own experience with sexless relationships.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Like, we get this sort of healing through osmosis just by seeing other people doing their own work. Like, we get this tangible benefit as well, because it touches the parts in us that relate to that and have been through similar experiences.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, that Marianne Williamson quote that always gets quoted in self-help circles about the more we allow our own light to shine, the more permission we give other people.
Yeah.
It's really about that, right?
Yeah.
It's like, as we do our own work, it's bringing light to the collective elements. It's collectively dispersing shame. And it's also allowing us to feel valuable in community,
right,
which many of us don't have.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Being able to not only be seen when we have things to celebrate and when we have things that we feel ashamed of is such an incredible thing. And also, I think for so many of us, it's hard to find those places.
Totally.
Because we don't even know that it's possible to do this kind of healing in group. I mean, for most of us, like, at the most we can do is find like a podcast, a book, or a therapist. Mm-hmm. And so being able to find places where we can actually be in spaces to feel the feelings and to be witnessed in our stories and to get that opportunity to see other people and be with other people in their stories, like, that's such a gift. And it's also really rare.
Yeah. It's life changing.
It is. Mm-hmm. So one of the other things that you use as something that you just personally really love to connect with, but also as a resource for people who are investigating new stories, is mythology. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear how mythology serves you in this work.
Well, it's kind of my first language in a way, as a witch and a heathen. I have such a deep love of story in general as a way of understanding our world, you know, such an important part of what makes us human. And so I started this group. It's an online thing that meets once a month where I tell people a mythological story and offer some poetry and some readings, and then we connect it to sexuality, to our own personal sexuality through discussion. And I did this because I really love working with archetypes as a way of understanding ourselves and understanding our world, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a fantastic way of really employing human imagination, which is like underestimated in its power, sexuality, you know? Actually, I just read, that reminds me, I've been reading Octavio Paz's book, The Double Flame, and he talks about what makes eroticism unique for humans is that it uses the imagination.
Yep.
And so often, you know, we're just in our habitual ways of being, we're in our inner critics, we're feeling unworthy, or if you're like, oh, I'm, you know, all these problems and how do I get out of it? Often just connecting to story or a mythology or archetype of a sexually powerful figure brings in this wonderful freshness, because then we get to like put ourselves into a different gear internally.
Yeah.
You know? Like, what if I put on the archetype of the Queen of Heaven, who lies underneath the apple tree and admires her wondrous vulva, as I was reading to people from this ancient Sumerian poetry? Or what if I put on the archetype of Artemis, you know, turning the guy who is like creeping on her from the bushes when she was bathing naked, turning him into a stag because she was so in her power about her anger that was how she enforced her boundaries. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, you know, these images are really potent. They can be really inspiring, you know, for us to deal with problems, issues in our own lives.
Yeah, I have found one of the things that has been really helpful for people in my own private practice is this tapping into the imagination, because for so many of us, it's completely foreign to exist in a body that we don't actively hate, that we aren't trying to control, that we're not trying to enforce or conform to standards that are outside of ourselves. We don't know how to be in our sexual power because we feel so much shame, or speaking up for ourselves in those really vulnerable moments is hard. And I found for so many people that to then fictionalize it, to turn it into a story, like if you were to write about someone who was fully in their sexual power, how might they be? What would they say? How would they stand? What wouldn't they apologize for? If you were going to write an erotic story about someone who worshipped bodies that looked just like yours, how might they be? What might they say? Mm-hmm. You know, and to invite people into that imaginary place offers then so many tangible permission slips, because now we've got like new stories that we can consider maybe then trying out in our own lives.
Totally. Yeah. And it's so important because, you know, a big part of sexual empowerment is not only helping people understand what to let go of and move away from, but it's helping them to develop the vision of what they want to move towards.
Yeah.
We really need that inspiration. Like that visionary element is so important.
Yes.
You know? And story is really helpful in assisting us to refine that and to find what truly feels good and nourishing and fun and juicy inside of us. It's like the lighthouse that helps us find out where we can move towards.
Yeah, and I'm even thinking like being able to create story with people that we're in relationship with is also a really fun exercise. So if you take turns like texting or emailing a story back and forth that you build on together, that can yield, so one, it's super fun, but two, it can yield all kinds of really interesting information about each other without it having to be like one of those intense, we're locked in face-to-face, like quote-unquote official talks. You know, that could be really fucking intimidating to like have a talk about our sex life. But if we can use our imagination and write some stories and ask some questions and engage with archetypes and like reading erotic Sumerian poetry to each other.
I highly recommend that one. That one served well in many a seduction, by the way.
That's exactly it, right? Like it's a way we can feel connected to each other without having to put it all on the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our imaginations can take us to such incredible places, and we limit them so much by feeling like they're frivolous or feeling like they don't really serve us, or even telling ourselves we're not really the kind of person that has much imagination.
Yes, exactly. Which is ironic because what we're then doing is using the human power of imagination to imagine that we don't have imagination. Yeah.
Which is just another way we mind fuck ourselves.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this is about like mind fucking ourselves in a more enjoyable way, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think so much of sexual empowerment, you know, in the long term, like, one thing to address sexual empowerment and desire in the early stages of a relationship when the new relationship energy is flowing and that is all very hot. But lately I've been really enjoying the longer term explorations of in a long term relationship.
Yeah.
You know, how do we use imagination to turn ourselves on and off? You know? Like how do we use imagination to find our way out of routine and feeling bored with ourselves.
So often
it's not even about wanting someone new, it's wanting to be someone new.
Oh God, I'm so glad you said that. That's something that I want every person listening to this episode to hear, like really hear in your bones that it's like often we seek newness because what we're rejecting is ourselves.
Yep.
And being able to find new ways to relate, to go deeper within, to express ourselves can often bring this sense of aliveness that we haven't had in a while. And it's about just our inner work rather than kind of seeking these external things as a band-aid.
Totally. Yeah. Inner work and inner play.
Yes.
Knowing how to find that inner renewal, how to, you know, and I think, you know, mystery is such an important element to desire. Like when someone is mysterious to us there, it's often very arousing. And I think it's important to remember, like, we need to be mysterious to ourselves as well.
Yeah.
Like, when we're trapped in routine, when we're trapped in this is how I do sex this certain way, or just this is how I live my life in this certain way, we don't really have arousal there. So we need to find ways of being more playful with ourselves and finding new sources of inspiration, you know, and in stories, in mythology, in art, in poetry. It's very personal. I think you have to find what works for you, but knowing how to turn yourself on, you know, how to find that, how to rediscover that mystery in yourself of I'm an erotic being and I'm different every day. That's such a wonderful internal source of this power.
So often we talk about things as if it's a linear line or even a wave. And I'm really interested lately in the imagery of like an infinity symbol.
Yeah.
Of this kind of weaving in and out and allowing for the ebb and the flow. Like our bodies sometimes feel really good and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they're tired and sometimes they're energetic. And sometimes our lives have lots of space for creativity and erotic energy. And sometimes they just don't.
Yeah.
And like it doesn't mean that something's wrong. It just means you're in a different part of moving through these really natural cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love so much of what you're offering around, like, the mystery truly is always there because we're constantly moving in and out.
Yeah, exactly. And again, coming back to Octavio Paz, he talks about the erotic is always moving between the poles of abstinence and license.
Mm.
So it's always flowing between these two points and kind of in an infinity loop. And he says that used to be dealt with on a collective scale, culturally, carnival and Lent.
Yeah.
And we experience that in many different cultures. But as we've lost many of these cultural traditions, it's shifted from the collective to the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely relate to that. I know, you know, earlier in my sexual journey, a big dynamic that was part of it was I would get into a monogamous relationship, you know, go into it wholeheartedly, end up needing to repress a lot of who I was sexually in order to stay in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know how to speak for what I really wanted and needed. And I felt like there was I needed to be a certain way. So I'd repress that, end up super resentful.
Yeah.
The relationship would fall apart. We'd break up. And then I'd just go on a bender.
Yeah.
And, you know, fuck a bunch of people and have this kind of wild period and then hit the shame wall and then go back into a monogamous relationship.
Yeah.
And yeah, not great, you know, not great. But even now, interestingly, I mean, I'm queer, I'm polyamorous, you know, a lot of my work in the last decade has been about creating a life where I really get to express who I am without apology and without hurting other people because they know that and they signed up to be with me.
Mm-hmm.
Now I notice there's still an internal dance between there's periods of immense erotic openness and feasting.
Yes.
And there's also times of fasting, and I have to say I'm in one right now and I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. And I think like something else that I want to invite all of us to just keep circling back to around this is so much of the ebb and flow can feel and honestly be disrupted. We might get stuck in one part of it, which isn't to say it's not there anymore, it's just we're kind of like hanging out without a lot of movement, is because we exist inside of a world that expects us to do 28 hours worth of things in 24.
Yeah, totally.
So parenting and multiple jobs and social lives and social media and taking care of ourselves and whatever that means and tending to aging parents and, you know, like all of those things, because we don't have more collective support where we're caring for each other, we then end up feeling like I have to do all these things on my own. And it's really difficult to connect with our inner mystery and our inner play when we're super exhausted. And so like even offering just some forgiveness and some space for ourselves around that, like maybe this particular period in my life is just really intense and that's how it's going to be for a while, but trusting that there is going to be movement in really small ways. And that I love how you're even saying like, I'm really enjoying this fasting, this kind of like, you know, energetic fasting that's happening, knowing you're going to move into feast again at some point. Like that feels so much more spacious than why am I here? I don't like it. I don't want to be here anymore. I'm going to resist what's true.
Oh, and you know, especially being someone whose professional work is in sexuality, we can put so much immense pressure on ourselves to have like the perfect sexual life.
Yes.
Oh my God, such a secret dark side, isn't it? Like our work is about telling people that their sexuality is fine no matter what, but how often do we judge ourselves because we're not doing it right?
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, the people who listen to the show now are different than the people who listened to the show way back in the beginning. And part of that is because way back in the beginning, the show was all around like my sexual experiences and Dylan's sexual experiences and us going to play parties and all these things. And I just kind of reached this point where it was like, I can't continue just being this kind of performative sexual being going on all these things and continue my life and my development. And I need to really shift the show where I can still share myself, but it's in a very different way.
Yeah.
So that it's more generative. And I still have feelings about that. Like, I've gotten a number of complaints that are like, we never hear about your stuff anymore. And it's kind of like, well, that's that I'll share it when it feels good, but I also get to keep some stuff for me. And I think as sexuality educators, we often feel like we have to make that performance like very public.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, which is another complicated edge of like when you are doing something that you love, but it's complicated by you have to turn it into a brand and into something that makes money.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the humanity of it easily gets lost. And I'm really not about that. I'm really actually in helping people to like find and defend their humanity.
Yes. Yes, please.
So, yeah, I mean, like you might not find a lot of spectacle here, but really, really into the humanity.
And to me, that's just so much more interesting over the long term.
Yeah.
You know, like spectacles are fun, but they're kind of fleeting.
Yeah.
And to me, I'd much rather have something that, like, there's still so much fun and play for me, but it's in this much more, like, I want to use that word feast again. Like, I feel like I'm feasting on the opportunities rather than just kind of like mindlessly consuming them and then feeling empty at the on the other side.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think it's interesting because in my own journey, you know, of like, I'm queer, I'm polyamorous. I've had a very high sex drive for most of my life. I was sexualized very early. So having a kind of precocious entryway into sexuality and then doing work in it professionally means like I've identified with it or been defined with this for a long part of my life. And for most of my life, I have fiercely, fiercely defended my right to explore sexuality outside the constraints of heteromonogamy and of this very, very narrow cultural ideal of how we're supposed to be sexual, you know, or how we're allowed to be sexual. And I think it's really one thing I appreciate about the age that we're living in is there's such a diversity of narratives that are coming out now about the many, many different ways that we get to be sexual beings and why we have the right to defend our autonomy in exploring these things. And it's so necessary because I wouldn't be who I am without this. You know, I think there's some alternative universe in which I'm like working in a law firm, engaged to some guy, totally repressing my desire to be with women, and like really hating myself, honestly, you know, because that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
All about the exploration and the defense of autonomy. And also, it's so necessary in finding our own humanity. And we also need to be attentive to the ways that we become more interested in seeking out new sensations and consuming experiences than we are able to really be present within what's happening, you know, and how we have the potential to really use anything as avoidance and escape.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that human beings are so incredible at is really using anything at all. We can use literally anything in our world as a numbing mechanism.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
again, our powers of imagination are really incredible.
Right. So like instead of, and sometimes numbing is about survival.
Totally.
And so like, I just want to be really compassionate that sometimes numbing is literally about surviving and coping something that's really terrible. And that's okay. And when we have a little bit more choice going on or a little bit more space to really be able to like, okay, I've noticed that I'm numbing in a lot of these places. What might it be to feel through some of this stuff that can feel really scary and explore what's on the other side of that?
Yeah, totally. And I think that that freedom opens up a lot of permission of seeing what's possible. Like I'd say I'm in a fasting stage right now in my human relationships, but I'm enjoying a very erotic relationship with the earth and with life and with my creativity.
Yeah.
And that's feeling very juicy and enjoyable.
Yes. And I think that's also something that's just like, you know, as we kind of come to a close, oh my God, but I could talk to you for 4 more hours. It's just like thinking about, and this is really what the summit's about this year too, is there's so much expansiveness. There's so many pathways available to us to engage with the erotic, to engage mm-hmm. with each other, to feel into our bodies and the depths of the pleasure that we have. And yet, so often we limit it and police it and force it into these super narrow confines because we're so afraid of being othered, of not being lovable, of being left behind, of not knowing there's alternatives. So even within your fasting, feeling this expansiveness, like that to me feels so exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also another big reason why we police and shrink back from this is because we're afraid of the ecstasy.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're afraid of how big the pleasure, the desire, the ecstasy feels. And it's because we've forgotten that we are that ecstasy.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. God, let's leave them with that.
Yeah.
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 For people who want to stay in touch with you, how can they find you online?
You can find my website at rewildingtheheart.com. And I have my little inner critic email course there if you want to sign up for that. You can also get access to my writing, my monthly mythology group, and hear about all the other work that I'm doing. And so that would be the best place, rewildingtheheart.com.
Yay. I will, of course, have the link to that in the show notes and at sexgetsreal.com for this episode. Leonor, thank you so much for being willing to go to these enormous theoretical places and to offer just such practical, real lived experience. It's been so fun.
Oh, it's so great. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah. So much appreciation. Yeah.
Yes. And to everybody who tuned in, please head to sexgetsreal.com if you have any questions or comments. Follow Leonor all of the places, and I will, of course, talk to you next week. Bye.
You used to light up like a spark. Now you're blue, treading water in the dark.
A huge thanks to the Vocal Few, the married duo behind the music featured in this week's intro and outro. Find them at vocalfew.com. Head to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show and get awesome weekly bonuses. As you look towards the next week, I wonder, what will you do differently that rewrites an old story, revitalizes a stuck relationship, or helps you to connect more deeply with your pleasure?
So don't be ashamed. Love is supposed to be.